right. Well, good evening. It's good to be with you all. I appreciate very much the invitation to come and to be a part of your summer series. I feel humbled that when I was looking at some of the names on the list, some guys that I've known for a very long time and that I've respected, and it's an honor and a privilege to be named among them, and so I'm grateful. I am a Northwest native, like some of you, I'm sure, and so I'm... But I've never been here, and so there are a lot of faces that I don't recognize, a lot of names that I recognize, but I don't know most of you, but I'm looking forward to the opportunity to get to know you and to get more acquainted. As was announced, I'm working with Kirkland and helping out Brent Hunter. As many of you know, he just had triple bypass surgery, so I'm helping fill in for him and sort of take up some of the load during the summer. And then I'm currently enrolled in the Biblical Studies program down at Florida College. And so up here for the summer, taking a break from my studies, but about to return in about a month here or so. But again, I'm grateful to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity for me and my wife to come and to be a part of you and spend some time with you this Wednesday evening. And so when I was asked which character in the Bible that I wanted to give a lesson on, it just so happened that I had just, probably the previous day or so, just listened to a great interview with one of the leading scholars when it comes to the topic of the Apostle Paul. And so I was fascinated, and maybe you've been in the situation where you're listening to someone who is at least 300 IQ above you, and you're just blown away, and your mind is trying to comprehend all the things that they're saying. And I was in a similar boat that evening. I was sort of blown away at all the stuff I heard, but this opportunity gave me a chance to sort of meditate on the Apostle Paul, chew on some things, and try to better understand the apostle and why he is the way he is, and why he was the way he was. And so this lesson gave me an opportunity to meditate on his life and his example that we have in the scriptures. And so I want to start by just asking the question, why even study the Apostle Paul? This study is going to be sort of a broad overview of Paul's life from what we can tell and what we can gather. We're going to be talking a lot about primarily what the state of the world was like and what the state of the world was like, particularly for a Jew living in the first century Palestine, as Paul was. We're going to talk a lot primarily about that, a lot about what we know about Paul's upbringing, the kind of person that he was before his encounter with Jesus on the Damascus Road. And so why study Paul at all? Why is so much attention over the years being given to this individual? So much so that entire branches of biblical scholarship, people go on and make their living for their entire lives studying this one individual, this one apostle. And so why is that? Really, I thought of it this way. How many of you, when you were in school, studied Shakespeare or Edgar Allan Poe or one of the great authors whose work has influenced culture so much? I know I did. I studied lots of those guys. And for most of you, what probably happened is before you actually got into whatever book you were reading, whether it was Romeo and Juliet or Hamlet or I can't remember exactly what Edgar Allan Poe wrote, but he wrote a number of short stories. Most of the time you do a study about the life of the individual, studying their upbringing, what the world was like for this individual when he wrote the things that he wrote, to try to get a better insight into why they wrote the things that they did. If you understand, for example, I remember studying about Edgar Allan Poe when I was a freshman in high school and learning about that he was a very depressed individual and had a horrific life. And so naturally that emotion and that upbringing came across in his writings, and you get to understand why he wrote some of the things that he did. And so that's really why so much attention has been given to the Apostle Paul, is to better understand why he wrote the things that he wrote. 13 of the 27 New Testament documents that we have before us, that we read and that we spend so much time thinking about and studying and that we warp our lives around, 13 of them were written by the Apostle Paul. And that is not counting Hebrews, for those who want to check my math. If you just count up the number of words, 28% of the words that are in the New Testament were written by the Apostle Paul, or attributed to the Apostle Paul. And so, if we spend so much time and put so much emphasis in studying guys like Shakespeare or other great authors whose work has played such an important role in shaping Western culture, then why shouldn't we do the same with the Apostle Paul? Why shouldn't we try to better understand his life, better understand what kind of man he was and what the world was like for the Apostle Paul growing up and what events shaped his writings? And so my goal and my prayer and hope for this class is that as we look at the apostle's life and the things that would have shaped him, that not only will it motivate us to then want to go and to read his writings and to better understand it, but also hopefully get some insight into maybe why Paul wrote some of the things that he did and emphasized some of the points that he emphasized throughout his writings. And so our agenda for the study this evening is we're going to start by looking at Judaism during the time of Paul. What was it like to be a Jew living in the first century? What sort of events had just happened? What things were being talked about and being discussed? And then we're going to look at what are different things that we know about Paul prior to his experience on the Damascus Road, where he encountered the risen Jesus. Then we're going to look at Paul's encounter with Jesus on the road to Damascus and the years to follow. And these three are really going to be our primary focus for this study. Then we're going to briefly look at Paul's call to the Gentiles, what he says and how he viewed his call and his mission to go and to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. And then finally, we're going to end with a brief application, and then we'll extend the invitation, and then the class will be yours. So I'm grateful to be with you all, and I hope that this is a beneficial study as we try to understand this great man a bit more. And so we're going to start with Judaism during the time of Paul, what the state of Judaism was like. And I think in order to better understand the Apostle Paul and why he was the way that he was, why he was such a zealous and fervent persecutor of Christians that we see when he first shows up on the scene, I think we need to first understand what it was like to be a Jew during the time of Paul. And so what was the state of Judaism when Paul arrived on the scene? A couple things to remember that really shaped the state of Judaism during the first century. Some key events that had happened or were happening. The first is that the Babylonian captivity had left the Jewish people completely or largely scattered among the neighboring nations. And they existed rather than existing as a unified nation, like God intended them to in Palestine, in the land of Israel and Canaan. The captivity, you remember the story of the captivity, the people, because of their sins and because of their idolatry, God raises up Babylon to come in and to take the people away. Well, the people never really ever truly recovered to the same, or became the same type of nation that they were, the same independent nation. They were always being governed by some other power, some other ruler. And so Judaism in the first century existed largely in these small pockets found within other surrounding nations in the ancient Near East. And so Judaism was a very scattered religion that was made up of small small populations within greater Gentile communities. The next thing that we have to, or the next major event, I think, that really shaped Judaism to what it was, is that this occurred during the intertestamental period, about 150 years prior to when the Apostle Paul came onto the scene. The Jewish people that were living in Jerusalem, that had re-inhabited the land, faced a horrific amount of persecution at the hand of a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes. And for those of you who have studied the intertestamental period, that name may ring a bell. Antiochus, or Antiochus, is how he's often pronounced. But this guy was one of the greatest persecutor of the Jews that the Jewish people have ever seen. It was a persecution that really would not be surpassed up until the time in which Jerusalem was destroyed. This guy named Antiochus Epiphanes, he was a king in the northern part of Palestine. And what he did is he came down into Jerusalem, walked into the temple, took control of it, and then he sacrificed a pig on the altar, completely desecrating the temple to the point where the Jewish people could not practice their religion and practice sacrifices anymore. But not only that, he took his persecution, he escalated his persecution, and it got so bad to the point where he made a decree that any woman who circumcises their son, according to the law, on the eighth day they were supposed to circumcise their male children as a sign of them being initiated into the people of God. He made a decree that any woman that circumcises their child would be killed, and the child would be hung around that mother's neck. And just a horrific persecution. And this is where we get the story. Eventually, a family called the Maccabees rose up and helped liberate and push Antiochus out of Palestine. But this was just 150 years prior to when Saul of Tarsus came onto the scene, and this radically shaped the perspective and the mindset of Jewish people. And then finally, what was going on currently during the time of when Paul came onto the scene, after Antiochus is kicked out of Rome, or out of Palestine, excuse me, his shoes are quickly filled by the Roman Empire, who march right in and take control of the area, and they begin oppressing the Jewish people, and they take control of the land. And so what resulted from all of these events was, first off, you had the Jewish people, and it instilled in them a extreme sense of Jewish nationalism and Jewish pride, that people were proud to be a Jew. People were proud to be God's chosen people. You think back to the captivity and what originally started the captivity and led the people away and invoked God to raise up and destroy the nation was that God's people, rather than being a unique people set apart from the world, that they wanted to be like all the other nations, and so they began worshiping other nations' gods and behaving and acting like the surrounding nations around them. Well, when all these events occur, the result is that they swung completely in the opposite direction, instilled a great sense of pride in being Jewish, pride in following the law, following the Torah. They no longer wanted to be like their Jewish neighbors. In fact, they wanted to be the complete opposite. They wanted, and they rejoiced that they stood out, because that meant that they were God's chosen people, and that God had chosen them above all the other nations to represent Him. And this seems to have played a large part in shaping Paul's mind in his early years. And we'll look a little bit more on that. So let's turn our attention now to what we know about Paul pre-Damascus Road, before his experience where he saw where he saw the risen Jesus on the road to Damascus. And so we're going to try here to sort of piece together what different things that we know about Saul of Tarsus, about Paul. And the first thing we'll remember, of course, The first thing we need to remember is that we call him Saul or Paul because this guy has two names. So if you're not maybe so familiar with these stories, and it sounds like I'm calling the same guy by two different names, it's because he had two different names. And so to clarify any confusion, Saul would have been his Hebrew name, while Paul would have been his Roman name. This was quite common that people that were born in this day would have been given multiple names to fit in with multiple groups of people. And so we know that Paul was born not in Jerusalem, but Paul actually was born and appeared to have been raised for the most part in his early years in one of these pockets of Jews that we just talked about. The technical term is diaspora Jews. These Jews that existed in these small communities within Gentile land and practiced Judaism in this local and this miniature sense, so to speak. We know that he originated from Tarsus. From what we can tell of Tarsus, Tarsus was a real prominent city back in those days, a real metropolis. It was a port city, which, if you know anything about the way ancient cities thrived, if you were a port city, that was a tremendous treasure, because it meant lots of income, lots of wealth was constantly being circulated through your city. And so from what we can tell, Tarsus was quite the booming city when Saul of Tarsus was growing up and was being raised here. It was along one of Rome's major trade routes, and so certainly it would have been a prosperous place to have been raised. We know that he was from the tribe of Benjamin. Most of this of what we know about him comes from his letters and the things that he wrote to other Christians. So Philippians 3 tells us that Paul tells us that he was from the tribe of Benjamin. And from what we can tell, what we can gather about his parents, it seems, from all the information that we have, that his parents were devout Jews and took their religion and their Jewish practices seriously. And we know that Paul tells us that he was circumcised on the eighth day, just like the law of Moses commanded that Jewish men to be. His parents would have had to travel down to Jerusalem to dedicate their son to God and to have him be circumcised, indicating their faith and their obedience to God and to the law of Moses. There's some indication that his father may have been a Pharisee. In Acts 23, verse 6, Paul claims that he was a son of a Pharisee. And granted, this could be just a turn of phrase, that he was a son of a Pharisee could technically just mean that he was a Pharisee, another way of saying that. But I think that when you look at, that's eventually what Paul replicated, that Paul eventually did become a Pharisee, that I don't think that there's any reason not to indicate that his father was as well. And so he was appeared to have been raised, from all that we can tell, in a very devout Jewish household with parents that were very devout to their religion and took their religion seriously. We know that, or we can assume that, his father was a tent maker, and from an early age, Paul probably was raised and picked up the trade, the tricks of the trade from his father. It was common for a father to pass on his means of living to his son and to teach them, and they would eventually take on those traits. And at some point, we don't know exactly when, but at some point when Paul was growing up, Paul was sent down and moved to Jerusalem to to follow in his father's footsteps and to become a Pharisee. The Pharisees were, in essence, the what you would equate to the biblical scholars of their day. They were the guys that wrote the commentaries, that did the translations, that did all the scholarly work, that read their Bibles constantly and wrote commentaries and various works expanding on the Bible. And so Paul would have received one of the greatest educations in the law that you could receive at that time. And we know that we read that he studied under the instruction of Rabbi Gamaliel. And this name may not mean anything to you at first, but from what we can gather from other Jewish sources, what scholars have gathered, we actually have some of the writings of Paul's teacher, Rabbi Gamaliel, still with us to this day, that you can go and find and read. From what we can tell, he was one of the most well-respected rabbis and one of the most respected Jewish teachers that existed during this time. And I think that this is alluded to. You remember back in Acts 5, when the apostles, when Peter and all of them are going and they're preaching Christ, and they're taken and they're brought before the Sanhedrin, they're brought before the Jewish courts, and they're commanded and they're told, you need to stop preaching in the name of Jesus or we're gonna beat you up and we may even kill you. The Jewish courts send them out, and that we read that there's a guy that stands up that we read was a well-respected teacher amongst the Jews. And what was his name? His name was Gamaliel, or Gamaliel, however you want to pronounce it. And what in essence he says is, he sort of calms the riot down and calms the Jewish courts down, saying that, you know, if these people are really bringing a message from God, well, then there's nothing that we can really do about it, so we should probably just let them go and let them keep doing their thing. And if they're not from God, then it's not going to work out, because remember all these other guys that came up and started preaching these new religions, and they eventually turned out to be nothing. So God's going to take care of it either way, so there's nothing that we can do. And he persuaded the people, certainly indicating that he was a man of great influence among this high-ranking these high-ranking members of the Jews. And so, certainly being one of this guy's students certainly would have been a prestigious title. Paul certainly would have had one of the greatest educations that you could have if you were a Jewish male living in his day. And so we combined all of this together, all this stuff that we know about Paul. This is Philippians 3, if you'd like to turn there and follow along, where it's up here on the board, if you'd like to follow along there. Paul appears here to be addressing a group of people that had put their faith and had put their trust in the fact that they were Jewish. The fact that before they had become Christians, they were Jews. And notice what his argument was here. Oh no. There we go. If anyone else thinks he has any reason for confidence in the flesh, then I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. As to the law, a Pharisee, that is a biblical scholar. As to zeal, I persecuted the church. And as to righteousness, under the law, blameless. Paul is making the argument here, and I think that we see that from what we just looked at, all the stuff that we know about him. Paul, in essence, was, when it came to Jews, Paul was the best of the best. In his words, he was a Hebrew of Hebrews. If you think that you can boast, he says, about just being Jewish, if you think you have a reason to boast, then I certainly have a reason to boast. I was the best of the best. I was top of my class. In Galatians 1, verse 14, he expands on this a little bit in saying that he advanced in his years far above his contemporaries. He was the best of the best, and he was making great strides. And I think it's a fair assumption, and it's not too much of a stretch to imagine that if Paul had never converted to Christianity, if Paul had never begun to follow Jesus, that he certainly would have been one of the greatest and most influential rabbis, Jewish teachers to ever live. I don't think that that's too far of a stretch, and I think that that's something that we're supposed to see when we look at Paul, when we look at Saul. So one more element that we need to look at that Paul addresses in Philippians 3, one of his arguments, is talking about his zeal. It was not uncommon, and we have writings from different groups of Jews throughout, from back in this time or around this time. It was not uncommon for Jewish circles to look at men like, that you read about, great heroes of faith, great men that were really passionate and zealous in the Old Testament. Guys like Elijah, who, you'll remember the story of when Elijah went up and challenged Jezebel's prophets of Baal which God could bring down fire to consume the offering in the book of Samuel, excuse me. And what happens after Elijah wins the contest is he takes all those prophets down and he executes them by the river. Or guys like Phinehas in Numbers 25, a little bit less well-known character, but you'll remember Moses got up before the people. God was upset because the Jewish men were intermarrying and having sexual relations with these Moabite women from the surrounding regions. And so Moses and the people they're weeping and they're so distraught that the people have gone this far and have done these horrible things. And so what does this guy named Phinehas does, who was the son of one of the sons of Aaron, or one of the descendants of Aaron? As the people are crying and as the people are mourning for the state of Israel, a Jewish man and a Moabite woman go into someone's tent. And so what does Phinehas do, that overcome with this zeal and this desire to serve God? He goes and he takes a spear and he goes into the guy's bedchamber and he kills them both while they're in their the bedroom. And then you look at guys like we mentioned briefly just in passing, Judas Maccabees, who was one of the guys that liberated the Jewish people by engaging in guerrilla warfare with Antiochus Epiphanes. And so it was common for sects of Judaism to look at some of these people who were so zealous to do what was right, even to the point of violence most of the time, and to look at these guys and say, that's what it means to be a zealous Jew. That's what it means to be a faithful Jew. To look at these guys, to look at the nation, and when the nation is starting to go astray, when Israel and its people are starting to engage in idolatry, are starting to behave like the world, the zealous and a good Jew is someone who takes up the spear and stops it no matter what. Even if it comes down to violence, a good Jew is someone that stops the people from becoming like the rest of the world, that stops Israel from becoming like that. And so if this is what the mindset is of what it means to be a faithful Jew, are we at all surprised that Saul, a Hebrew of Hebrews, the best of the best, would try to replicate this? I don't think it's a surprise at all. I think it's expected. And so, of course, it's no surprise then that what we see him engaging in. We see him going around when we're first introduced to him and holding the coats of of people as they stone Stephen, as they stone Christians, Jews who have come to believe and to profess that Jesus is God. And he goes around and he takes Christians and he throws them into prison because that's, in his mind, that's what it means to be a faithful Jew. It's to stop Israel from going down the wrong path, no matter what the cost, even if it comes down to violence against your own people. And so this is eventually what leads Saul to go up to Damascus, to be on the Damascus road. You remember it says that he went to the high priest. He hears word that there are some Jews gathering up in Damascus. And so he goes to the high priest, he goes to the Jewish courts, to the officials, and he asks for permission to go up and to take these people and to throw them into prison, because remember that's what a good Jew does. And so it's in this instance where he meets the risen Jesus. If you have your Bibles, it'll be on the screen, but if you'd like to follow along, Acts 26, this is one of Paul's retellings of what occurred and what happened, in Paul's own words on the road to Damascus. And so this is, I think, a good indication of how Paul saw the events that occurred. In this connection, this is Paul talking to King Agrippa here. In this connection, I journeyed to Damascus with the authority and the commission of the chief priests. At midday, O king, I saw that there was on the way a light from heaven, brighter than the sun, that shone around me and those who journeyed with me. And when we had fallen to the ground, I heard a great voice saying to me in the Hebrew language, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads. And I said to the voice, Who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. But rise and stand upon your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you as a servant and a witness to the teachings in which you have seen in me and those in which I will appear to you, or which will appear to you, delivering you from the people and from the Gentiles, to whom I am sending you, to whom I am sending you to open their eyes, so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness from sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. I think that this is one of the most interesting accounts of Paul's conversion. Interesting to hear how Paul phrases it, how Paul thinks of it. Lots of work has actually been done on this particular account of Paul's conversion. And lots of people have noticed that this conversion account, the way that Paul words it and Paul phrases it, it echoes some of the calls of some of Israel's great prophets that were sent out to the people of Israel, particularly the prophet Ezekiel. It was a common practice for Jews in Paul's day to meditate upon some of the appearances of God and the calls of some of these great prophets, and to meditate upon the language and the vocabulary used when God appears and people see God's glory. And so some people have suggested that that's what maybe Paul was doing as he traveled on the road to Damascus, as he was focusing on the vision of Ezekiel, and that's why he's using such similar language. You can go back and look at Ezekiel 2 and verse, or 1 and 2. You'll remember that Ezekiel is distraught because it's his birthday, and it's the time in which, if he were in Jerusalem, he would have been anointed and been able to become a priest. And he is distraught because he so badly wants to serve God and to serve in that capacity. But God's glory appears to him on a chariot of fire, a mobile chariot, throne of fire. And Ezekiel, it goes through this in vivid imagery, this language of Ezekiel focusing on all the things that he sees, of these cherubim, these angelic figures going all around. And then eventually getting closer and closer until eventually he looks at the image sitting on the throne. And some have suggested that maybe that's what Paul was doing as he journeyed up to Damascus, as he was thinking about this vision in Ezekiel, thinking about this experience of Ezekiel seeing God's glory, and then Jesus appeared to him. And except as he gets to the figure sitting on the throne, he sees Jesus sitting on the throne. Some have suggested that. Here are some of the similarities. I don't know well how you can see it. Some of the similarities between the call narratives. And I think it's just fascinating, and it sheds some light on how Paul saw his call and how Paul saw his mission. Is Paul viewed himself in the same, to be of the same category as some of these great prophets to Israel, except you'll remember most of the prophets that are called to go and to preach in the Old Testament, they're called to go and to preach to the nation of Israel who has fallen away, and to get them to turn their hearts back to God, except Paul, in his case, is called to get the Gentiles to come and to turn their hearts back to God. And so Paul sees himself, it appears as though Paul sees himself as carrying on that tradition of these great prophets of God. Acts 9 tells us what transpires after Jesus appearing to him. You remember it says that he's blinded and he fasts for 3 days. Just think about that for a moment. Why do you think that Paul fasted what do you think Paul was doing during those 3 days of not eating and of not seeing? I think that it's safe to assume that he was trying to understand what just happened to him. Here it was, Paul goes up to Damascus thinking that he's, you know, doing exactly what God would want him to do. And on the way, he's sort of smacked in the face, in a sense, by God, and he's blinded. And so I'm sure you could imagine that Paul was meditating and thinking about what had just happened to him, what had just transpired, and imagining the implications of what it meant if Jesus was really God and Jesus was really the Messiah that he'd been waiting for. So we have a couple minutes left, and so I'll try to get through some of the rest of this. What we can piece together from Paul's retelling of it in Galatians 1 and Acts 9, we can kind of see what happens during Paul's years after the road to Damascus. We see that Paul arrives in Damascus finally, and he's baptized by Ananias, a guy by the name of Ananias. And then we read from Galatians that after that happens, Paul goes down to Arabia for 3 years. No one really knows why. Some speculation has been done. One of the best example, or one of the best speculations that I've heard so far, is that maybe he went to Mount Sinai like Elijah did, to ask God, you know, what's going on, and then have God explain things to him, to then eventually have God send him back to Damascus, just like happened with Elijah. So maybe that's true, but I think that's nonetheless, it's speculation. And so he returns to Damascus, and after these 3 years, and he's preaching in the synagogues, and that's where we read that the Jews and the people there wanted to kill him, and so he's led down in a basket along the city walls. And then he goes and he travels to Jerusalem to meet up with Peter and the rest of the apostles, and to explain what's happened to him. And you can imagine that from what we know, this is, or from what we can tell, this is the the first time Paul's been back to Jerusalem since he was there in the capacity of persecuting and throwing Christians in prison. So, of course, when he gets back, the Christians are weary of him and scared of him, but you'll remember that Barnabas steps up for him and pleads his case. After leaving Jerusalem, we read that he goes and he sails for Tarsus. And then after he leaves Jerusalem and goes to Tarsus, there's this period of about 10 years that we really don't know what happened to Paul. It's sort of a mystery. Again, people have speculated. I think that there's two things I think we can almost certainly conclude and that really aren't a stretch. One is that Paul probably returned to Tarsus to, like most of us would do if we had this experience, to go and to try to convince his Jewish family that of what he's experienced and to try to share that and try to get his family to see that Jesus is Israel's Messiah. And this may be what Paul is alluding to in Romans 9 when he's saying that, you know, if I had the choice, if I could, I would rather be cut off from and separated from Christ if it meant that my kinsmen and my brothers would obey the gospel. And then secondly, I think it's safe to assume that Paul spent a lot of this time studying and rethinking and rereading through the scriptures through his new frame of mind. His newfound understanding of Jesus as Israel's Messiah. I think certainly it required a lot of rethinking and rewiring in his mind of the Hebrew scriptures. I think that's safe to assume. And so lastly, and we'll end with just a couple more thoughts. I appreciate your good attention this evening. At the end of the silent years, we read that Paul is in Antioch. The next thing we read about him, he's in Antioch and he's preaching, he's teaching, and working with the church there. And then Barnabas, the guy that previously advocated for him, says, "Hey, I'm going on a mission trip. I'm going on a journey to the Gentiles, and I need someone that has experience in that regard, dealing with these Jews that." These pockets of Jews and Gentile area, and so he calls, of course, on Paul. And I think Paul was the Lord made the right choice in choosing Paul, because who would have known better how to reach these people than someone who grew up in this situation and a well-respected Jew like Paul? He was going into familiar territory and familiar turf, it would seem. And so I'll just end with this for this evening. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all. I know that this was a lot of information that I kind of threw out, but I appreciate your good attention. And so in way of application, I'll just end with this. Paul, in my mind, when I think of how I can apply Paul's life to my own, Paul's always been an example to me of someone who valued serving God above everything else. We looked a lot at Paul's life previously and all the fame and prestige that Paul certainly had being in the position that he was, having the greatest education, the greatest position, being highly elevated and exalting him, being brighter than all his other contemporaries. But rather than valuing that prestige and valuing that position, Paul stands out as a guy who his primary concern above everything else was serving God. And he valued serving God and serving God to the best of his ability more than anything else that he had. And so this evening, I'll end with this invitation. What, I guess, could you say the same thing about yourself? Do you love God, and are you serious about serving God enough to, so much so that it takes priority above everything else, above your job, above your work, above your family, above whatever it is that takes precedent in your life, that holds that top shelf in your life? And have you, would you give that up if it meant serving God better? If you're here this evening and you are a Christian, but you've stumbled, you've gotten distracted, and you need the help of the brethren here, you need some prayers, then we give this opportunity for you. Or if you are here and this is all new to you, and you're lost, but you would like to learn more, and you would like to, or if you're here and you would like to become a Christian, you would like to be baptized, you would like to begin your walk as a disciple of Jesus Christ, and we can help you in any way. We invite you to come to the forward, to come to the front. If there's anything else that we can do for you at all, please come to the front while we stand and while we sing number 5 or number